So we're in .NET world again, .NET 4.5, and this time we're going to talk about multi-core JIT. We are with...
Hi, I'm Dan Taylor. I'm a PM on the CLI performance team.
I'm Rick Brewster. I'm a software design engineer in Windows, and I work on Windows Performance Analyzer.
Excellent. Speaking of performance...
And I'm Vance Morrison. I'm the performance architect for the .NET runtime.
Excellent. So now when we had a conversation, we were doing a series of these .NET 4.5 things on Channel 9. We had a conversation about ASP.NET's use of these modern features that Vance and team have made, and the whole .NET 4.5 team. Multi-core JIT came up, and we didn't spend any time on it. Now we are. So tell us what it is, and then we'll dig into how it works and how wonderful it is.
Right. So first, multi-core JIT is this great new feature in .NET 4.5. It started with in Silverlight 5, actually. What it does is essentially it parallelizes some of the JIT compilation that happens on the startup of your application. Now, historically, we have used NGen as the solution to that problem, but NGen works particularly well only with applications that have an installer. So with Silverlight 5, those applications don't have installers, so we brought in multi-core JIT to parallelize some of that JIT compilation time. And then last time we talked about ASP.NET. There is another place where we said, hey, we can reduce a lot of this JIT time, and Bing had fantastic results. So today we're going to talk about how this feature can be useful for desktop applications.
Excellent. And we should also dig into how it works.
Yeah. So the fundamental issue with multi-core JIT, so the idea is you want to parallelize all this JIT compilation. But the problem with that is that jitting is normally this very lazy operation. You jit a method, and then you realize you need to, you call that method, and then it realizes it has to jit that method, and then you call another method, and it has to jit that method. So you don't know what the next method is you need to jit. And so that's our fundamental problem, is that you know you're going to be doing a lot of jitting, but you don't know exactly which methods are until you run it, at which point it's too late. And so what we have to do is we have to remember something from the previous run, which is all the jitting that happened on the previous run, and now we have a good idea of what we're going to jit this time around, and then we'll know what to jit before we need it. Mm. And that way we can get that second processor going, jitting on things while we're executing, and then it's always sort of ahead of us. But it can only do that because it's clairvoyant. It knows what the likely next things that need to be jitted are. And so that means that we can't just do it magically for you.
Sure.
We can't just sort of magically use that second core. You have to help us by telling us when to start and where to put this file that remembers from run to run.
Cool.
You want to talk about it?
Yeah, so it's actually only two method calls for most applications. You just give me a folder which has a list of multi-core JIT profiles. So using the profile optimization class, you can just say, here's a folder of all my multi-core JIT profiles, and then you just say, call this method that says start profile. And so the first time your application launches, it'll be in what we call recording mode, which it'll observe all of the methods that you JIT as your application runs, and then it'll save that profile to disk at an appropriate time. The next time your application starts, that call will look for that profile, and if it's found, it'll start playing back, which means it'll start jitting ahead of time all of the methods that are saved into that profile.
Okay.
So the nuts and bolts of this is that there's a new class. It's called System Runtime Profile Optimization. And as Dan mentioned, it has exactly two methods on it. One of them is called profile root, and that's something that the application has to choose. And it's basically a directory where we're going to put this data file that we create. And then the other thing was the start profile. And you can have many of those. So every time you have a start profile in your application, we start looking for jitting. Mm. And we'll remember all those things. And we'll put them in a separate file in that directory that you told us. So you can have an application. So it's typical that an application will have one for startup. But it might also be you open a new window, or you do various big things that tend to open up and run a lot of code. Those are new places where you might want to have a start profile. Mm. Is that what you did in your application? You ended up doing it not only on startup, but also
No, we haven't gone that far.
Okay.
Right now, we're choosing which profile to use based on the command line parameters, so that we use one profile if you give no command line parameters, or you're opening it blank, or we use another profile if you're telling it to open a file while you're opening the program. And so, Windows Performance Analyzer. Actually, there's a third scenario where you're opening the program, the trace, the ETL trace, and you're also loading a profile, which also instantiates a bunch of graphs and data tables that get loaded.
You essentially have a switch on the type of startup that you have.
Right. So you end up seeing profiles called startup 0, 1, and 2.
Yeah. So that's one of the approaches. The other one that we've designed for is that you have this multi-stage startup where you know your application starts up and you get to some sort of menu and then you take some sort of action and then you can have a profile for that action the user takes. So both of those methods work equally well.
Excellent.
Right. The one of the cool things is that it's literally just those two things. One thing at the very beginning of your program somewhere that tells us where to put things, and then you can put a bunch of different calls to the start profile. It really boils down to how many times you have times when lots of jitting happens.
Okay.
And so we decide when to stop recording. So you tell us when to start. And then we just watch whether jitting is happening. And when jitting stops happening for a long enough period of time, we just say, okay, you're done. Because, you could imagine if you waited way long, hours, you'd be jitting methods that you aren't going to use for hours. Mm. That's not very useful. You want something that's going to be used in the next few seconds for it to be useful.
Sure.
So we stop after it when jitting sort of trails off. Mm. Typically, what we'll find is that on applications, it depends on how much jitting is going on, but it's not uncommon to have hundreds of milliseconds to small numbers of seconds, like 2 or 3 seconds worth of jitting, and you're going to save half of that, right? Well, you're going to save, roughly speaking, half because you've got another In the best world, you can imagine you're running and it's jitting and you never actually do any jitting. It's always the secondary thread who's doing all the jitting. Mm. But in reality, most of the time what will happen is it'll do some jitting in the background. You're running and then you hit something that it didn't get to quite yet.
I see.
And then so you have to jit that. And then you run a little bit more and in fact you trip over a bunch of ones that it's already jitted and so those go lightning fast. Mm. And you breeze through everything that he's already jitted and then you have to jit yourself. While you're jitting, the other guy's jitting too. So you end up usually 50%, 60% of the total jit time you can recover by dumping it off onto the second core.
Excellent.
I like to give the guidance that just by implementing these two method calls, you can save on the range of 20 to 50% of your application startup time.
Really? That much?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's very common. So the more jitting you have, the more it sort of asymptotically tends to approach that 50% mark.
Right. So just for people's education, I mean, when you say it's a little confusing in the sense that how much jitting you're going to do. The fact is, when you write a .NET app, you get IL. And if you don't engine this stuff, you have to jit.
Right.
So what do you mean by how much jitting you're going to have to do? You're going to have to jit. That's my question.
That's right.
So yeah, is the question of how you know how significant.
I guess it's just to clarify.
So, do you want me to talk?
So it just depends on how much code you have to run through as your application.
I understand. So it depends on how big your IL file is.
Not necessarily your IL file. It depends how much of the IL file you
use on your scenario. So,
got it.
So for example, we like to encourage people on their startup path to have as little code as possible. And in fact, you can do a pretty good job because most GUI apps, they're calling all sorts of WPF or GUI framework APIs. Mm-hmm. That's doing a boatload of execution. Mm-hmm. But the number of calls that you had to make that happen, dozens. So mm-hmm. you're talking about 30, 50 methods being jitted. That's not a big deal. That's under 100 milliseconds.
Okay.
But on the other hand, if you have a big application that you've written a whole boatload of code that gets run on startup, now you're talking, hundreds of milliseconds, 1,000 milliseconds, something that it becomes interesting to use multi-core JIT for.
Well, it's not even you also have to, you know, if you move that work off the startup path, you delay it. At some point, you're going to have to do that work anyways. Yeah. For example, maybe you load up a bunch of graphs or something like that. So the best practice is to remove everything as possible, as much as possible from your startup path. But then when you need to actually do this productive work, then multi-core JIT can really reduce those load times as well.
The WPA example is actually instructive here. Rick mentioned that they started with, you know, startup scenarios. And so you can start the app and do nothing, and it just brings up the GUI without any data in it. You could start the app with a data file present, in which case it has to do that. And then, frankly, that's where you win, right? That's where you're doing a lot of your own code. And they wanted it to be Xcopy deployable, so NGen wasn't an option for them because you need an installer for that. But you could do this other thing, which is, let's assume you started up the app and then you loaded the ETL files a second step. Today,
kind of multi-stage startup.
Today, you will end up jitting everything on the foreground thread today. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so, but you could imagine sticking in that start profile and poof. That scenario would be covered.
We're still figuring out maybe other ways that we can use it. This is code that we just sort of found out and started playing with about a week or two ago. So we're still getting to terms with it. But the Xcopy deployment scenario is not just important for WPA, but for just sort of portable apps in general, where maybe you get a zip file instead of an MSI, or maybe you just copy the installation, put it on a USB stick, and then take it to another computer.
Yeah.
The first time you run it, it'll be all JIT, but then the second time, it'll be a bit faster.
Yeah.
So I have I work with Perfu, which is a tool very similar to WPA, and it has the same Xcopy desire that WPA has, it turns out that Perfu, when you launch it, it uses so few methods to sort of bring up its GUI that I'd save a little bit using this, and so I probably will do it because it's so easy, but it's not a big win. It's not a huge win, but. On the other hand, if I could do it when I was about to open a profile, that would be a bigger win for me because that's when I'm using more of my own code, and because I'm Xcopy, I don't NGen it, and therefore I am paying some JIT costs there.
But multi-core JIT will help you in that scenario, right?
It will.
Excellent.
It will.
Because it's up to the user to decide when to call it to run it.
Yep, that's exactly.
It's configurable.
And if you want to see just how easy it is to turn this on, we have a bit of an interesting story here, how we got WPA up and running with this feature. For the Visual Studio launch videos, I actually go through implementing how exactly to implement multi-core JIT in your application. I use this paint.net application as an example. Now, paint.net normally does use NGen, but it was a very canonical type of application which would benefit from this feature. Mm. But Rick Brewster here actually is the developer for paint.net. After seeing the results with paint.net, he decided to go and put it into a bunch of other products in the performance team in Windows that use multi-core JIT.
Can you repeat the win that you got from...
So there's four projects I've applied this to. There's Windows Performance Analyzer that we already talked about. And I think the gains there on a startup without opening a file went from about 4 seconds to 3 seconds. If you boot it up while you're opening a trace file, it takes 12 seconds, but with the multi-core JIT, it drops down to 9. It's pretty fantastic. Another project in my group that I applied it to was Windows Assessment Console, and its startup went from, I think, 4 seconds to about 3? Mm-hmm. Or was it? No, I think it was 3 to 2.5. It was about a 17% gainer, so not very big, but it was free.
It was noticeable. Yeah, it was so easy.
It was noticeable, and actually, I took a trace that I then loaded up in WPA, or a trace of the startup of those programs, basically, without anything with, recording. No, it was an NGen cold startup, and then with multi-core JIT, and you can see, if you line the graphs up right, you just see this graph going. You see a CPU usage graph going from this amount of time to this amount of time to this amount of time. So multi-core JIT kind of gets you about halfway there.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And then the paint.net results were even more dramatic, where if you install pre-release, of course, version of paint.net 4.0, then you remove it from NGen, and then you have this extra code added to the startup path so that it uses multi-core JIT. it goes from 6 seconds to about, what was it, 3 seconds?
Yeah, just over 3 seconds.
Yeah. And the total amount of CPU usage time is reported in something like Process Explorer or Task Manager. Stays about the same, but it's noticeably faster.
Parallelized.
Like, you could show it to anyone, and they would immediately notice the difference.
So it is parallelized. So I know in Windows, you guys have some beefy test machines. I mean, how well does this scale?
It doesn't really. So the
So it's dual.
The reason
it's
is
dual
this,
core JIT.
So the it is dual core JIT, and, okay. And there's a reason for that.
Okay, tell us.
And it's not actually that much harder for us to, you know, once you sort of put things off the thread, sort of say have five background threads or whatever, however many you want. It's actually not that hard to do. It's just that we don't want to add complexity, and especially concurrency complexity to testing and so forth, unless it buys us something. So, and you say, oh, what? It could buy you something. If you're on a quad core, you go from, you know, 50% to you only have 25% of the time, right? What's the problem? And the answer is it doesn't work that way because of the situation that I described in the beginning, which is that you're chugging along doing, you know, jitting things and then executing things. In the meantime, the background threads are trying really hard to sort of anticipate your needs and provide things. There's a problem that it has, which is that if it's one way of doing that is sort of start at the back of the list and work forward. And the problem with that is you're sort of guaranteed to meet halfway in the middle. The other way is to sort of jump ahead a little bit and then jit the methods that are you know that you're about to use, and then you'll be executing those and you'll jump ahead. And if you do that just perfectly, you could even get better than 50%. You could get 60 or 70%. The bottom line was that what we found was that we could not get that second, when you would go from more than two cores, it was really hard to get utilization much better because of these other effects. The fact that the profile is not always perfect, and the fact that you have to decide exactly which, you know, methods, which ones you're going to jump in head, and then there's concurrency problems within the threads. They have to stay out of each other's way and so forth. So it boiled down to we got the vast majority of the benefit with just two, and we said that's good enough.
Okay.
So we might go there, but it's probably only going to give us 10% more or something like that. Not the, you know, we got 50% of the win with two. I get it. You can get like 10% more, maybe.
Okay.
So that's why we didn't do it. I do want to mention one other thing, which is that we think this is great. We think people should use it. But you should do what I did when I was evaluating. I had an app, and I said, you know, I feel like I could take advantage of multi-core JIT. How much is this going to save me? Like, is this worth, you know, doing? Now, it's pretty easy to do. So if it saves you anything, you should probably be doing it.
Okay.
But this will also set the expectation of what you can save.
Mm.
And so all you need to know is, well, how much jitting am I doing? And you can answer that question. So the Perfew tool, if you take a trace, one of the things that you will find in that trace is something called JIT stats. And if you open that, you will find a page that tells you exactly how much jitting you're doing, and in fact exactly which methods you're jitting and how long each method took to jit and so forth.
Okay.
And so if you go to the download center, download Perfew, and then take a trace of your application at its startup or whatever scenario you're interested in, you can get a very good idea of how much multicore JIT will save you.
Cool.
And the very good idea is, you know,
half of what you see on that
yeah. So if you take your overall startup time and you look at how much JIT was on there, divide the JIT in half, that's a pretty good estimator for how much you'll end up with startup time.
Okay. And so back to, you know, you guys using this is great because it's one hand to talk about it. The people who make it love it and are passionate about it and know a lot about it and want everyone to use it. In the real world, you're using it, and it's shown you've actually seen, you know, benefits. Anything to share with people who might jump on this as well? I mean, things to think about, things to watch out for, you know, design decisions, etc. How does it impact the way that you?
Biggest trick is probably just figuring out how you're going to use the profiles. Like, are you going to pick what kind of profile you're going to use at startup, or are you going to use a multi-staged approach where you say, you know, here's the very beginning, then I'm going to do another profile when I start loading a file or when I start booting up other parts of the program. Mm. Really, though, it's just...
Do you want to talk about your 4.0 thing?
.NET 4.0?
Yeah.
The other interesting thing that you can do is, if you're compiling for .NET 4.0, and you haven't upgraded to 4.5 yet for any number of reasons, maybe...
Can I interrupt for a second? Just as a piece of background,
sure.
Is that the important aspect of this is that this is a 4.5 feature.
Yes.
So even though .NET 4.5 is an in-place update, which means that if you don't do anything and you're running Windows Update, probably several months from now, you'll just have 4.5 on your machine. But if you're developing an application that's going to be sent out to everywhere, mm-hmm. you don't know whether people have 4.5 or 4.0 on their machine. Mm. And this API doesn't exist in 4.0. So you'll get a method not found exception mm-hmm. if you just sort of wire it in and you're not on a 4.5 machine, a machine that has 4.5. And so Rick is going to tell you how to fix that particular problem.
Right. So for the projects that I've applied it to, well, actually for all of them, we're still compiling for .NET 4.0 just because, these are essentially, it's what our first versions were released to require, and we don't want to just force everybody to upgrade to .NET 4.5 just because we added a 20% or 50% or whatever performance startup improvement. Mm-hmm. So what I did is it was just kind of an experiment at first where I asked, well, does this even possible? And they said, Dan said, well, I think it is, but we haven't tried it. Mm-hmm. So I actually... I use Reflection to get access to it at runtime, even though I've compiled for 4.0.
Okay.
And it still works fantastically well. And I've posted a code snippet on my blog that you can just use straight in your code.
What's your blog again?
Blog.getpaint.net.
Okay, great. But, that's interesting. You use Reflection, but Reflection has a performance overhead. So
yeah.
What's the balance?
It still wins.
It doesn't matter?
Yeah. Well, the answer is he's doing Reflection on one method.
Yes.
and so, yes, Reflection should be used with care.
Yes.
This is a reasonable place to use a small amount of Reflection to get a fairly big win.
So now I have a question. Let's jump just briefly back into the design of this. And I guess I'll point the camera at you, being Mr. Program Manager responsible for this feature. Why, in some sense, why wouldn't... Let's say I'm writing an app, it's 4.5.
Yep.
Why do I have to tell you anything?
Yeah.
Why should I have to say, oh, I want this to happen at startup, oh, I want this to happen with this big chunk of code? I mean, I'm in my IDE, I'm writing my code, you know what my code is, you already have a front-end compiler already that can reason about things. Why don't you just multi-JIT, why don't you do it for me?
I think the answer is, so in general, with .NET, we try and do as much for you as possible, so the answer is that it's just too hard to do that kind of static analysis.
I should mention, to be fair to Dan...
It's good to ask hard questions. Dan.
He wasn't there, actually.
Oh, all right.
So, actually, you should be pointing the camera at me, because if it's historical, because he owned this feature after it had done
that kind of
development.
So what's going on? Why isn't it just an automatic kind of thing?
Well, so... You described, so the question is it possible, right?
Yes.
And you're saying, hey, you've got all the code in the app, why can't you figure it out, right? And the answer is, we actually tried.
We
said, how much can you do with static analysis? So in other words, just looking at your app, we know main is called, and then main, we can look at the methods inside main, and we can say, well, we can guess based upon if conditions are true or false, we can sort of guess about what methods go. That falls over very quickly. It only takes one or two hops and you're hopelessly in the weeds. Worse is that, think about this, we're only, even with this, let's assume that you guessed right half the time.
Mm-hmm.
That means you are jitting twice as many methods as you should have been. So you could easily eat up your gains. You really need pretty close to perfect guess. At what you're going to use. And that's in fact why, and then you'll notice the thing that Rick ran into. Hey, when I launch my app, depending upon what the command line parameters are, which I certainly don't know at development time, I don't know when you built it, I go down wildly different code paths. And so it's just impossible to predict.
Understood.
There could also be other environmental settings that affect it, like say in paint.net you can configure which tool is selected at startup. And so essentially, depending on registry values, you know, which toolbar widgets are initialized and put in the UI will be different. And we don't yet have psychic powers in the Kotlin framework. So once we get that,
Clairvoyance is useful, isn't it?
You're gonna have to use more than two cores to get that kind of stuff.
So I think the long and short of it is where we can do the right thing for you, we do that. But we've tried to make it as easy as possible to get this incremental bit of performance. And really, anyone who benefits from it, it should be a no-brainer.
When we started this feature, some people were saying, "Can't you just say JIT me, or you know, or give me an API that says, you know, I'm about to call this method, so go ahead and, or give me a list of methods." And we toyed with those. That's actually relatively easy for us to implement. Like, we could have given you an API that says, here's a list of methods, JIT them for me because I call this API, and so that when I get there, you know, I can, that they'll already be JITted for me. And that works. Like, you know, if the application developer is sufficiently clairvoyant and puts in the right APL calls, it'll work really quite well. It could work better than what we have. But if you think about what they'd have to do in order to do that, they would need to run something that would keep it, a developer. I defy a developer to actually come up with a list of methods that are called, especially if you want them in order, that their application runs. It's not possible. You're going to need a tool. Oh, you know, and then it changes as all sorts of things change. And then, you know,
It becomes a tax.
I'm never doing this. So we said, what's the least thing we could do to get most of the benefit? And so we said, we will take care of doing it. Oh, by the way, you know, there's a disadvantage of this. The first time your application runs, you don't get this benefit, right? Because we're not clairvoyant. We can't pre-JIT JIT the things that we don't know to JIT. Mm-hmm. All we can do is record. But what is true is that if you started, you know, you tended to use your application in a certain way and start up in a certain way, and then you changed a piece of configuration, you changed some config options, and now it starts up in a very different way, well, we will JIT the wrong methods for once, and then we'll notice that, we'll remember the new methods, and now we'll JIT the new thing. And so it's self-correcting, and...
Isn't there a way to specify that if the JIT notices that something's changed in terms of start, I mean, you actually have to run it once before. There's no way, like if I change configurations, for you to
so keep in mind
flip a bit that says the thing that you just did no longer matters.
From a .NET perspective, from the JIT's perspective, what's configuration?
Sure.
Is it an XML file? Is it something in the registry?
Fair
it could
enough.
Be anywhere, right? And we don't know. Again, clairvoyance is needed.
Clairvoyance.net. No, I understand. I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Just for people out there, I mean, the JIT is a compiler.
Yeah.
So if you look at what compilers do today, modern compilers, they do take advantage of multiple cores today, right? The back end certainly does, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at different languages, the front end certainly does. So I still kind of want to get, I don't want to harp on this because I understand the complexity and the purpose of runtime compilation.
So the difference is that this is a just-in-time compiler, and it's only compiling the methods that your application is going to need, whereas multi-core compilers know that it has to compile the entire source file at build time, which is actually a very expensive operation on the order of multiple seconds.
Yes, for sure.
So in this case, it's a particularly difficult problem to solve because we only want to compile the methods you're going to use, and we don't know which methods those are until your application actually executes and runs.
So this is a question I would ask then. I mean, is the JIT always hot? So what I mean by that is if you're running on a machine that has four cores and you're running a .NET application, the JIT, couldn't you have something that's just sitting there in the background monitoring?
Monitoring.
So the CLR, the runtime.
So
monitoring what functions are going to be called.
Okay,
like somehow just sitting there sort of spying.
Okay, it's
on,
monitoring. What does it do with that information?
It will fire off a JIT when it sees.
But that's too late, right?
Because it's running.
Because you don't know that you need the method until you just started executing it. Oh,
fair
well,
enough.
I've already, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Trouble. Yeah, it's already too late.
Interesting. It's a hard problem. I'm just trying to crack into you know, various angles to see why it is such a hard problem, because on the offset, it's easy to say,
Yeah. You need to be able to predict. So you can imagine a certain amount of that can be done by, if one method, if you're jitting one method and you see an unconditional call to another method, you know you're going to, you know, I'm about to enter that method, mm-hmm. and I just said it was unconditionally going to call another method, so I know I'm going to call that other method. Unfortunately, the time it takes to execute that one call to like get to the other one, there's no win there. There's if that was looping for a while and then called unconditionally that other method, then I'd have something, but that doesn't happen. All right, we can't predict that with enough. That doesn't happen often enough for us to make it worthwhile.
Understood. So what else? I mean, what else can we talk about here? I mean, what you want to develop? What's the call to action to you, your fellow .NET developers? In other words, this is not something they get for free. They need to think through when to target, what to target.
Right. So for, as I mentioned before, Silverlight and ASP.NET, this is actually something that you do get for free. So that's great if you're on.
How does that work for Silverlight? How does that work?
So those applications are essentially hosted. And so we know a certain set of things about them, and we can automatically turn on this profiling for those types of applications.
I see. So the basic, so think about why you had to opt in. You needed to tell me where to put the files, mm-hmm. and you needed to tell me what the scenario is. So in the case of Silverlight, they already have a hive, like, you know, where they put stuff. So Silverlight, the runtime, you know, the runtime that is Silverlight, mm-hmm. already has a place.
Okay.
And the scenario is startup, because that's the important one. So they have the two things that they need.
Okay.
They can give us the two pieces of information we need, and we're done. Similarly, ASP.NET, they know when a web page is first starting, and that's probably the important scenario. And they also know, they also have a place to put the files that they own, that that's a legitimate place to put it.
Okay.
So they too have the thing. So we're just, you just have to act like the host for us. So if someone already had a place and already knows what the scenario is, they should be doing this.
Okay. It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, so I would say the call to action is, first, as Vance mentioned, just crack open Purview and see if this is worthwhile for you.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could just try it and see if it's worthwhile for you. Either one of those, I think, is
trying is pretty easy.
Perfectly acceptable. Whichever one is easiest for you, you should go do. If it helps you, you should absolutely do it. There's nothing.
Yeah,
like,
it's so easy.
Yeah.
The only caveat to that is the versioning ugliness, the fact that you have to have version 4.5. So if you just call, you know, if you build for 4.5, that's great. Your app will only run for 4.5. If you don't want to take that dependency, which is for at least a little while, that's probably, you probably don't want to take that dependency, because there's a lot more 4.0 installations out there than there are 4. I mean, we haven't actually officially shipped right now. I don't think so. So there are very few 4.5s out there yet. In a year from now, that'll be very different. But at the moment, it might be worth doing something like what Rick did.
Right.
Getpaint.net.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's the URL.
Yes.
Right on. So what else? Tell us.
Well, to complete my thought from earlier, the idea of using it from .NET 4.0 if 4.5 is installed is so that you can give your users or customers who have installed .NET 4.5 a free performance boost at startup.
Right.
But you won't inconvenience the people who haven't upgraded yet or who aren't willing to upgrade yet. And so if you're doing like a dot release, like, you know, 1.0.1, you don't generally rev your dependencies, your platform dependencies, when you do that.
Right.
Generally wait for like a 2.0 or, you know, 2.5 or something like that to do that.
So, and the final question I will ask is, when, you know, you certainly will know this, Vance, given all of the telemetry and dumps you've looked over the years, or, you know, whatever, your traces and all the stuff. The question I would ask is, when you look at startup for a classic .NET application, mm-hmm. how much of the time is JIT? How much is loading a bunch of stuff into memory, like a bunch of assemblies?
Yeah.
How does that work?
So startup is complicated, and frankly, it's very app specific. It's complicated first by this notion of hot versus cold disk. Mm. So if this is the very first time this application was brought into memory at all, so it was on, you know, cold, what's called cold startup, your startup time will almost certainly be dominated by the cost of the disk I/O necessary to bring those things into memory. Mm-hmm. And JIT time will not be that dominant in all likelihood. It will be dwarfed by the disk I/O. But if that's not true, if you launch the app, or if it doesn't, you don't even have to have launched that app. You just need to have launched other things that that brought much of the needed code into memory. So when even the framework is cold, like all the .NET framework is cold, mm-hmm. all of that has to be brought in from the disk, and that's when things are the most slow. But if it's that other .NET apps have run, and then your app runs for the very first time, only your stuff needs to be brought in from the disk, and so it's quite a bit faster. Mm-hmm. So there's that variation, and that's the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, what matters is if you is how much your app does at startup. We preach a mantra: as little as you possibly can. Well-written apps really should be getting GUI apps, at least, should be getting to put up the GUI and let somebody start, like, you know, mousing on things. And that really shouldn't, if your app is calling more than hundreds, if you're in the thousands of methods in that tank, you really should be able to do quite a bit better. Mm-hmm. You should be in the 100 to 200 range. Okay. If you're in the thousands or even worse, I've seen traces 5,000, you have a problem where your app, you want to display this piece of information, you have to open a database, you have to do a bunch of stuff, you have to do a bunch of computation, blah, 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 and you just have to wait. But I'll tell you, your users would probably be happier if you brought up a GUI and then put up some sort of loading dialog box that sort of told it what they were doing with a cancel button, mm-hmm. if they decided that they launched this application, you know, incorrectly, mm-hmm. And that would be a much better experience. So the mantra we always preach is do as little as possible at startup and then do it some later point.
Excellent. Great. Well, this is great to come and talk to you guys again and learn about this cool new feature.
Yep.
For 4 or 5 developers especially, and it's nice to meet somebody from the real world, even though it's internal, so it's semi-real world. Just kidding.
I would call it the real world.
Well, you're Windows, man, you're family, right? So it's nice to see that it's actually making yeah. benefits in your life, just as it does for Bing, who we met last time.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. We'll come back and talk to you guys again for something else.
Cool.
Cheers.
I would